Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects. Kind of rainy in parts of Wisconsin today, and it's cold in other parts of the state. You may not be seeing a lot of insects outside anyway, right today anyway, but you know what? Won't be long. And maybe yesterday and over the weekend was some nice weather in a lot of Wisconsin. You saw some things. Larry Mueller here, my guest Phil Pelletieri, who is our bug expert, our insect guy. Number to call for questions for him, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Phil, always great. Thanks for coming by.
Nice to be here.
We have some things, bugs that are kind of active or starting to become active this year, this time of the year, maybe the tent caterpillars?
Well, yeah. You know, one of the things that you try to preach to people, because so often when I was running the diagnostic lab, is I'd get the call or specimens about a week or two late for doing anything of any significance. And,
yeah.
And you can pretty well be assured things like tent caterpillar and euonymus caterpillar and some of the aphids are all primed to start to become active as soon as the buds break and we start to see leaves. And then you can often interact and deal with these things very easily, hand crush them, scrape them off and whatnot. If you let them go 3 weeks from now, then they're going to be big and crawling all over the plant and be more difficult to deal with. So if somebody's historically had a problem, best advice I can give them is take a nice slow walk and observe what's going on in the plants. You see something doesn't look right, look closely. And oftentimes what you're going to do is be able to intercept some of these problems. So again, we have some of the soft flies on conifers that I would worry about. Again, tent caterpillar is a classic because as soon as the tent starts, it might only be the size of a quarter, but it's there. And as I said, you can pretty well be assured it's about the time when you've got just this first small leaf showing up on the plants.
And they're feeding on the leaves then?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And they'll be feeding for the next 3 to 4 weeks. And as I said, so often when we get the call, they're already crawling off the plant. And, you know, we tease people about revenge treatments. But, you know, it makes you feel better. But the two issues is you're not helping the plant out anymore. The damage has already been done. And secondly, with the dynamics of insect populations, it doesn't do any good to control them then because you're not going to influence next year's population. There's just too many other things going on.
And what do we see them later as moths or butterflies or what are they?
They're a little dark brownish, rusty-colored moth that will show up about July. Really pretty innocent. And, you know, the problem with moths, there's so many different species that unless you really spend a lot of time looking at them, they have a very interesting scalloping to the edge of their wings that is pretty diagnostic. But that's when they mate. That's when they lay this clutch of eggs that are kind of cemented on small twigs. And they'll stay in that egg stage all the way until the next spring.
Now, mosquitoes, I was out over the weekend with outside practically the entire weekend, and no mosquito, didn't see any mosquitoes.
And you could have, you know, so we've got 54 kinds, and one of the games is that there is a handful of mosquitoes that spend the winter as adults, a handful of species. So you could have a mosquito bite in the 1st of March if you had the right day and one of those woke up. But when you talk about the problematic mosquitoes in Wisconsin, whether the ones associated with spring snowmelt or the ones with spring flooding, it's still too early because they were in the egg stage. So they have to have things basically flood and warm up enough for them to develop. And usually it's somewhere around Memorial Day when it's going to hit the fan. And of course, up north, it's going to be quite delayed with you know, as cold as it's been. And even down here, my suspicions, it's going to be a little bit later than normal. We might get through that holiday without a whole lot of pressure, just again, because the spring has been so slow to warm up.
Well, Rob in Green Bay has a question for you. So let's go to Rob. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was up in the Whisker Lake Wilderness area up north this weekend doing some camping, and I had heard, I think on a story I'd heard on NPR or WPR at some point, that our real cold, our real extremely cold winters, like our negative 40s that we had this winter, would do a lot to control or kill off the tick population or the tick hatch for that following spring and summer. But when I was up camping this weekend, man, I was crawling with ticks. And so I guess I heard wrong, and I was just calling to get the straight story on that type of situation.
You know, I've heard that quote, and I'm absolutely confused of where it comes from because, you know, ticks get down the litter, and then you throw the snow cover on them. And so a 40 below air temperature doesn't do anything. And so I was not expecting, and as I said, I've seen the same quotes and I just can't trace it back to where it comes from because I didn't see anything this winter. The only thing that I would suspect would be tough on the ticks is if we had that kind of cold with no snow for insulation or significant icing, which again might cause some oxygen problems for them. But yeah, I guess I didn't see anything that I would expect. Across the board, I mean, the one thing that did get a lot of press was Emerald Ash Borer, because you start getting them below 30 below and it's tough on that individual critter. But so many other critters are just so well adapted. And as I said, I just don't know any science that would support it'd be cold enough to kill the ticks off here.
Well, there you go, Rob. Thanks. Dave in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I have a tick-related question as well. I work at a boys' camp in northern Wisconsin, specifically the Trout Lake, a little bit north of Woodruff, Wisconsin.
Yeah, pretty area.
A gorgeous area. And our boys are outside and very active all of the time, and certainly from time to time they present themselves with a wood tick or a deer tick. And our protocol thus far has simply been to remove the critter and monitor the site. And we have a nurse on campgrounds. And if we observe anything on that site, then the Howard Young Medical Facility is right down the road. Last summer, we were told we didn't need to keep the animal. And I'm wondering if Phil agrees that that would still be a good protocol to use and if it wasn't necessary for us to keep the tick.
Well, there's two things to me that are useful pieces of information if you decide that there's going to potentially need to be some more medical intervention. The difference between a wood tick and a deer tick is quite significant because we're not getting disease mm-hmm. transmission from wood ticks, and deer ticks we are. So, right. Again, if you're comfortable with what the tick is, they don't have to see it. But then the second point is by looking at the tick, you can pretty much get an idea, was the tick just beginning to become established and not feeding? So we're, you know, before that 36 hours of contact, or was the tick starting to swell, which means indeed it's been there for an extended period of time. And again, that's an important cutoff because, you know, right now the recommendations that CDC is using is if it's a deer tick and it was on your person for more than 36 hours and in a state that above 20% of the adult ticks are carrying Lyme, and we're averaging 35 to 40 in this state. What they're treating people with is prophylactically one day's antibiotic. At least that's what their recommendations are. Now, not all physicians, you know, go with that. But so to me, that's the two pieces of information. Is it the right kind of tick? And was it there long enough? Because those would help to determine if you should indeed consider that prophylactic treatment. If it was a wood tick or we know that the tick was removed before that, we really have no concerns.
There you go.
Right. Yeah. The wood ticks really don't bother us, they don't seem to bother the boys either. So just to repeat, but if we notice this deer tick has increased in size in any way at all, and we're familiar with seeing them right away, then the recommendation you have is that they receive this one-day prophylactic.
Right. And, you know, you often see a change of color in the abdomen of the female ticks in particular. They change from that kind of reddish-orange to start getting to be almost neutral color. And then, of course, as they start to swell, they get gray in color. But yeah, you can see they start to swell up like a pillow. And as I said, so that's often when I'm looking at ticks in the laboratory, the kind of thing I'm trying to determine and pass that information on so people can talk to their physicians about it.
There you go. Thank you very much, Dave, for calling. Appreciate your call.
Very useful information.
Yeah, thank you. And Chris in Janesville has a question for you. Hi, Chris.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hey, I've got a problem, I guess, in my house and also kind of in the plants I keep out of my deck with earwigs. I've got a rather large locust tree that kind of overhangs the deck in that area, and it buds a lot and drops a lot of kind of vegetative matter, and the deck itself is frequently kind of wet and moist and damp, and from what I understand, that's kind of a ideal habitat. I just curious if you had any maybe ticks or tips or tricks on keeping earwigs there in line, on not only in the plants and stuff that we keep on the deck, but also that inevitably get into the house.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, I mean, earwigs, it amazes me sometimes the sheer numbers in somebody's backyard in the little bit of problem they present. Their problem is they're out feeding at night, and they're both a plant feeder, and that's where you get some damage on things like marigolds and hostas and the like. But they also feed on insects. They're omnivorous. But when the sun comes up, they're looking for places that are cool, damp, and dark. So, you know, one of the things I teased about when I'm lecturing, I said that the ultimate solution is make your backyard a sandbox. No plant material, a lot of sun, a lot of dry. You know, that's just not an environment you expect to find them in. So anything you can do to kind of reduce those kind of things, just again, is slanting things away from the environment they prefer. You know, when they come indoors, it's a dead end. That's the good news. They can't breed in there. There's nothing to eat. But if they come in numbers, usually what we start to think of is what weakness, where are they crawling through? You know, and you start to have to look at every pipe that comes out, every vent that comes out, make sure things are caulked. You also look between that interface between the siding and the foundation, which is a place that things can squeeze up. Again, if you can keep plant material away to kind of keep that drier so it's a more hostile environment. Now, the interesting thing, I think, to me is watching earwigs in this part of the state. You know, they're not near as nasty as they were 20 years ago when they first were really starting to rock and roll here. And that seems to be a typical pattern. But if you do have an annual problem and the like, and of course you're not going to take all the shrubbery out of the backyard to change the habitat, you do have the option of treating. And the thing about treating earwigs, they typically come out of the ground about Memorial Day, and they're already half grown. They've been taken care of by their mothers. And so when you start seeing the first earwigs, you know it's time. And generally, you start to think of places that are damp and dark, and, you know, so heavily mulched areas and those kind of areas are where they're hiding. And those are where you treat. And in particular, lots of things work, but how you apply it to me is more important. In this case, you want to drench, you want to soak to get down into where they're hiding during the day. And this is one of those few cases where those hose end attachments may be more appropriate than a sprayer, because that's what allowing you to put the volume on to get it deep enough. Indoors, to be honest, I really don't think it's practical to spray. They're already in there. You just kind of catch them and sweep them up, and you've already let them get in, type of thing. So I'm not a big proponent of doing a lot of spraying indoors for this. But as I said, you know, spraying mulched areas and the like where they're kind of hiding places, treating underneath the plants in particular, because you notice how they like to hide under the pot. So you treat underneath the plant, and you'll get the best kind of control.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the call. Mike, calling from France?
Bonjour, Larry, Phil.
Bonjour.
I didn't know if Phil would be the guy to ask, but it's a plant-related and bug-related thing. Terrible trouble with slugs over here, eating everything, snails and slugs, and wondering if Phil has any good tricks up his sleeve.
Well, you know, they don't respond to insecticides. They're a different animal, and insecticides are not made. And, you know, one of the dilemmas here is if you had something that had a lot of slug activity, it probably would be quite toxic to earthworms. And so now you've got this environmental conflict. But what does work? There are formulated baits. Some use methaldehyde, and some, although these have become quite a bit more restricted and less available, use a product called Measurol. And they sprinkle the baits out. And the slugs are attracted to them, and it literally paralyzes them. And then when the sun comes up, the sun does them in. They're small pelleted baits in most cases, and you sprinkle them very lightly if you follow directions. And so the only dilemma with it is that the perfect slug weather is when it's damp and rainy, and so the baits tend to wash down, and so you have to reapply them. Now, for that reason, I've seen them take these and put the baits inside a little umbrella-like trap, with the idea you can attract it, but yet it's kind of weatherproof. But that really is the most effective in vegetable gardens, the ginseng growers in Wisconsin who have quite a slug problem because they grow the stuff under shade cloth and they keep it well watered and there's all this mulch and stuff. So that's slug heaven. As I said, they tend to go with the baits. But that being said, you can, again, anything that you use to dry the environment, to open it up, to get better airflow, makes it more difficult for the slugs. And then there are home remedies. And the beer baits and whatnot work to a degree. I've even seen in this climate, because although the books tell you that slugs overwinter as eggs, I see adult slugs right away when I lift up a rock in the spring. And so some people I know will literally put out these kind of rocks or shingles or whatnot that the slugs will accumulate during the day, and then they can pick them up and use it kind of like a slug trap. So it's, you know, kind of labor intensive. But again, if you understand what they're looking for biologically and try to provide that, you can see where you can kind of concentrate them, and you know what, again, would argue that you take care of those ones in the spring and knock the numbers down before they get a chance to reproduce. It should help you out in the long run.
Yeah.
Well, if I may say, we are extremely damp here most of the time. It gets sunny during the day, but there's always a very heavy dew at night. And I tell people that if you were to put a pencil into the ground here, you'd end up with a pencil tree. Things grow that well, but it's also very conducive to the slugs.
Yeah, they love it lush. I mean, that's just the easy way. And then, of course, you know, we don't see a lot of it in Wisconsin, but some of these giant slugs that you run in, both I've seen some of the European species out in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, there are some slugs that their size of small dogs is really quite amazing.
I've seen them. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thanks for calling from France. Appreciate that very much. Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, our guest today as we talk about the world of insect. He's former director of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, retired. I almost want to say, well, yeah, you're retired, I guess.
Yeah, I at least I've not been coming to work the last couple, 3 months, so if that or I got fired, I don't know.
but he's still coming in to talk with you and with me about the world of insects, so great to have him along. You can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you have a photo, maybe there's an insect you want to have us identify, or Phil, I shouldn't say us, Phil will identify it. You can go to my Facebook page, at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to see that as well. Thomas in Manitowoc has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. I'm so happy that you're still on the radio, Phil, because you know everything about bugs. But what I wanted to ask was, when we're skinning a deer in the fall during deer season, and there's already snow on the ground, and you get in an area around the neck, and there's the thing is all full of wood ticks, from real little ones that are just getting started to the real big ones that are already full. Do those stay on the deer the whole winter long, or do they fall off periodically and just survive laying on the cold, snowy ground?
So what you're finding is not really the wood tick. It's something that we call the winter tick, and it's closely related. It's in the same genus of ticks as the wood tick. But the difference is the way they feed. And so most of our ticks, the deer tick, the wood tick, which is technically called the American dog tick, are what we call three-host ticks. So they get on an animal, feed for a few days, and they drop off, and then they have to wait. The winter tick is a one-host tick. So once it gets on the animal, it doesn't go away. It stays there, even after it's done feeding. And so you get this buildup of these ticks and of all life stages. Now, when the female finally is totally engorged and she's an adult, she will drop off and lay eggs and continue the life cycle. So it's a different cycle. It's a very unique cycle. We would not expect to find winter ticks on people because you wouldn't let them sit there that long. But the deer, of course, has no capacity, especially when they're on that nick area, of getting them off. And so that's why you see this accumulation. And the other thing that people have to keep in mind about ticks is, unlike mosquitoes that, you know, one could be feeding on Larry and then fly over and pick on me, ticks have a very long process of feeding, and they're not really adept at dropping off an animal if they've been feeding for a period of time and then getting on another animal. That's just not the way they work. And so you really don't worry so much about bringing a deer. And you can have a lot of ticks falling off the animal, but as far as infesting your house or infesting you, I just don't expect that problem at all.
Hmm.
Okay. One thing about the winter ticks, do they carry the disease of other ticks, or very low incidence?
I'm not aware of any human disease that they transmit. I suspect that there's a couple wildlife diseases that wouldn't surprise me. In fact, there's a lot of questions with some of the problems with the moose populations in Minnesota and the like, that these ticks are having an impact on it, because you do tend to see quite an accumulation of these on moose in particular, and just exactly what they they are involved with this, but I would not be surprised that they're a component to the population reductions. And, you know, some people have tied this in with climate changes and other things. They said I'm not sure it's really clear cut, but they're an interesting tick. And if I had to tell you, my experience is generally the northern part of the state, they're far more prevalent, and they're really not very common in the southern part of the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There we go. Thanks, Tom. Brian in West Allis, we turn to you next. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
Morning.
It's kind of a two-part question. I had a hill in my yard full of red ants, and I was trying to figure out how to get rid of it. And all of a sudden, one year, ground bees took over. The ants are gone. And I guess the question is where do the ants go? Did the bees eat them? And how do I get rid of the bees?
Okay. So as far as ground bees, are something you see in the spring, or was it just a single hole, and in the end of the summer, there's all kinds of things coming out of the hole?
All kinds of things. I mean, they just took over this anthill, red ant.
So the first thing was those were probably field ants, and they have colonies that can grow for 10 to 12 years. And so these are often, when you burn a prairie, you see this large mound out there. That's an old field ant nest. But eventually the queen dies, and when she dies, the colony's done. So I think that was probably the first thing that happened, is the colony was not active. But now we have this cavity in the ground, which is exactly what the ground nesting yellow jackets are looking for. So a queen found that in the spring, and she started her housekeeping and setting up a paper wasp nest in the ground. And then by the end of summer, you've got this tremendously active colony. But the good news about the way those things work is that they die out in the fall. They don't come back to the same nest. Other than making the argument, they're looking for gopher burrows and rodent holes, or again, in this case, an ant nest. So could another one find the same hole the next year and start a nest? Possibly. So the way you combat that is that if there's any kind of opening that you see at this time of the year, you plug it up. You put dirt in it, whatnot, because they are not very efficient diggers. I mean, they can dig to some degree, but it's not as if they just go into a hill and dig a great big cavity to make their nest. They're looking for something that pre-exists and taking advantage of that.
Very good. So then I didn't want to kill them, per se. I'd let them go through their cycle and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pretty active right now, but I did notice that they disappeared in the fall. I don't want to smother them. So I just cover it up in the fall time then?
Sure. But that's what I was fishing for. So if you're seeing a number of critters hitting it, they've got to be solitary bees. I mean, we have some species of bees that are only active in the spring. It's not unusual to see a bunch of them in an area, but biologically what's different is rather than having a queen with a big colony, each individual makes its own burrow in the ground. Most of these are pollen collectors and the like. So you see 2 weeks of activity, lots of critters, and then they're gone. And you don't see them till the next year. And because there's no true nest to defend, they're very docile. So I don't worry about spring bees. I really don't, because they just don't have an aggressive nature. Whereas in the fall of the year, when you're dealing with these colony-forming yellow jackets, I mean, as we know, you can have some very unfortunate cases of people mowing lawns or walking and falling into a nest and picking up multiple stings. And they are far more of a health concern if there's a lot of people or pet traffic. If they're out in the woods, who cares? They've got a beneficial side. But if they're in an area that's a lot of people traffic, you got to be very careful, because any disturbance, they take great offense at.
Mm-hmm. I got you. Spring bee then. So.
All right.
I'll just enjoy it then. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Enjoy. Ron in Ashland. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you doing, sir?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
See, sir, where I live at, it's right in the grove, actually, of Norway pines. You know, I'm surrounded by them. My question is, now in the spring and in the summer, I have a bad case of spiders coming in my house. I mean, all kinds of varieties, black ones, brown ones, like, God, even to one point where one was like, almost looked like a transparent one, you know? And I see advertised them electronic repellers, I think they're all kind of like, you plug them into your socket, your light socket, or your outlets. Do them actually work?
They do not. I wish they did. It would make our life a lot easier, but there is no science to suggest. And so, yeah, it's not worth the investment. It really is not.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure. I've seen them, you know, like advertising on, you know, different in catalogs and whatever, you know.
No,
Yeah, the Federal Trade Commission has been chasing those companies around for as long as I've been an entomologist, and they keep popping up and the like. And, you know, and once in a while you get the coincidence of somebody will buy one, and it was a bad spider year, and boy, they thought they worked just great. But as I said, when you do the test, the same thing for cockroaches, same thing for rodents. I've seen some of these things, but it was always kind of curious that you could have a pet hamster that wasn't disturbed, but the rat was not happy. And so I know Dr. Craven and I have talked about this, and it just doesn't work that way. And, you know, the one question to you is do you have some big security lighting around the house?
Well, no, not actually. I mean, you know, other than the street lights outside, you know, okay. I mean, it's kind of a real rural area, you know.
Any water close by?
Right in the plantation.
Yeah, any water close by?
The ground is real kind of like a sandy black soil mix, kind of more on the sandy side.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But, what I was fishing for is, you know, typically if you live next to a lake, it's just going to be spider misery or spider heaven, depending on how you want to define it, because there's so many critters that come off the water, and then usually if you have any lights, you attract them, and then, well, that's what the spiders are all about. They eat insects. And so usually there's something involved here that's driving it. Big insect populations, then spiders take advantage of it. But, you know, we've got wandering spiders, so the way they do their thing is they run around at night looking for prey, and then wherever they are when the morning starts, they take... So we have these things wandering in the house, and which is a mistake on their part, but they don't know any better. But it's a little interesting, because typically if you've got mature pine trees, that's a little bit of an insect desert. I mean, when you think about it, there's not a lot of litter in the like in the ground for bugs to be happy with. And so I'm a little surprised, you know, again, without big security lighting, without being right next to the water, that you're having quite the problem you are.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. Good luck to you, Ron.
I live probably about maybe a mile from the lake.
Yeah. Well,
that's far enough that probably shouldn't have too much of a problem with it.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Sarah, from Campbellsport, says she went for a run on Christmas Day. And she found a woolly bear caterpillar on top of a snowbank. She brought it in, warmed it up, and it crawled around and seemed fine. She'd like to know, how did it get there? How did it survive the cold?
Well, it's really quite interesting. So woolly bears, true woolly bears, their game is to spend the winter as a full-grown caterpillar. And then when it finally does warm up about this time of the year, then they transform, spin a cocoon, and the moth will come out in 3 or 4 weeks or so. One of the interesting things in this state is back about 15 years ago, we had a new species of cutworm that came here. It's a European species, and it's known as the winter cutworm because it overwinters like the woolly bear as a partially to fully grown caterpillar. And same thing, I get these all the time on the snow. And you know, the interesting biological question to ask is, being cold-blooded, insects should not be able to move when the temperature is below about 45 degrees. Now, usually when you see this phenomena, you've had, you know, some kind of warm-up again, you know, a little warm-up before the snowstorm hit, and then they just happen to be kind of trapped out there. Because, as I said, if you get consistently below 30 degrees, they just can't. They physically can't get the muscles moving. So I have no explanation other than, again, it was in a microclimate that was warm enough to get it active. It started moving around. And the one thing that never made sense to me biologically about woolly bears is, if you found a good place, sheltered place to spend the winter, why should you wake up and go crawling around on the nice day in November? Because then you might lose your place. I mean, you got to find another one, but yet that's the way they work. And, you know, they will stay active as long as the temperature allows them to. And the other thing for kids, when they bring them in, we often warn people that if they've not been exposed to a pretty significant spell of cold weather, they don't develop. It's a physiological thing. It's kind of like a trigger.
Okay.
So you think you're doing them a favor by bringing them indoors, and honestly, you're not, because all you're doing is causing them to burn up their energy, and they're not eating anything and the like. Now, once in a while, you get successful, and one will have met the criteria. But generally speaking, it's better to take them and keep them in a very cool place. You know, garage is fine. Even a basement, if it's cool enough, is fine, so that they stay in that kind of stupor, and then warm them up at the normal time so they can develop and you can let them go.
James in Baraboo emailed us and wondered if you'd comment on the literally billions of lake flies that emerged from Devil's Lake over the last couple of weeks. They covered the rocks on the tumbled rocks trail along the west shore of the lake. Wondering if fish eat them? James saw some warblers feeding on them.
Oh, yeah. And the interesting thing to me is I'd have to look at them closely because we get stone flies and mayflies. I mean, there is just a whole bunch of aquatic insects that you get these mass emergences. Usually it's a very seasonal, very short-term thing. And of course, a lot of these are very important fish food. And you know, the ones that come out of streams are what keep the people who are fly fishers so excited because, you know, knowing when the mayfly hatches or the stonefly hatch or the caddisfly hatch. Both the larval stage for fish and then the adult stage for birds. But, you know, because it's only a 2-week period of time, usually whatever's feeding on them has to have another food source at the rest of the year. But it's a great glut. In fact, one of my colleagues, Dr. Gratton, is working up in Iceland where the lake flies that come off the lake are very important for moving nitrogen and other nutrients in the environment.
Huh.
Because they're basically dying off in the land, and this provides, as they degrade, nutrients to the plants and very important in the ecology of that area. So it's really very fascinating in some areas. And the same thing, the sheer mass of insects coming off some of those water bodies are just mind-boggling. It's like a science fiction movie.
Alan in New Holstein, you are next. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm having a problem with my lawn. I've replanted it twice now, and the grass starts to come up, and then it dies off. What I'm seeing, though, is in the soil, there's like little eruptions in the soil. And I'm wondering if I've got something in the way of grubs, or is there some other kind of pest that that I'm dealing with here?
Well, my first thought is the eruptions may be worm castings. And you get these kind of little, you know, they're kind of soil-like, but not quite. And they're usually kind of little volcanoes might be a way of putting it, or something similar. Very often in the spring. And so that's not related. You know, turf is a particularly difficult crop to diagnose because whatever kills it, it kind of looks the same. And although we do have chinch bugs and grub problems, from what you describe and the reoccurrence, and again, considering the kind of weather patterns we have, I'm more suspicious of a disease. And so now it gets more complicated because a number of diseases affect the roots of turf. And really the only way you can get this sorted out is probably to send a sample in. And the university does have a turf disease diagnostic lab, and they will accept samples. And what they're looking for in particular is that interface between where there's living and dead stuff. And usually you send them a little plug in the mail, and they charge. I don't at the top know what it is, but probably about a $20, $30 charge for a homeowner sample. And then they will make a recommendation. Sometimes it's changing grass varieties. Once in a while, it's using chemicals, but usually not. Usually it's trying to be more of an environmental change to get away from the problem and let things get more stable. And as I said, I think if you're really trying to get at the heart of this, that's what it's going to take to sort it through. And again, even visually looking at it, you send somebody a picture, I mean, they have to look at it microscopically, decide you know what organism is causing the problem.
Do you know what grass you're using or grass seed?
I've tried a couple of different national brands, you know, high-quality seed and designed for sun and shade and so forth. So trying to cover the spectrum, and it's the grass will start to come up, and then it just kind of dwindles off, and it goes back to a big area of bare ground.
Yeah, well, you know, they talk about melting out disease, and I said it's really quite interesting, but the way things, you know, so sometimes the size of the dead patches is somewhat diagnostic. The type of grass, you know, and I'm sure they're throwing some fescue and some bluegrass and ryegrass, but I mean, all those things come to play when they're looking at it. And as I said, so that's what they're doing. Or there are some varieties, and this is the unfortunate thing, is that sometimes they'll make recommendations, and it'll be a little hard to chase the seed down, but there are things that are more tolerant of some of these diseases. But as I said, you got to know exactly what you're dealing with to see which direction you have to go. So I think it'd be worth, especially, you know, I think you did what I would do is, you know, try something different and see if it makes a change. But if it hasn't, as I said, I think you need some more help in figuring out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. There you go. I would, it was kind of a funny, well, an interesting story from my point of view anyway. I do a morning 5K thing through our neighborhood. And I came on down one side street, and there's a lawn, and on one side of the drive, one side of the sidewalk, it's bright green, and on the other side of the sidewalk, it is yellow, kind of a dead, almost dead looking. And I'm sure that's zoysia grass.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, that, you know, you get into some of these things that you find they sell that maybe do well in other climates, but
don't do great in Georgia.
Right. Or some of these grasses are late to color up here, and mm-hmm. they die early. And as I said, so there's all these variables that fit in. But again, the background you're giving me really suggests a root disease in particular.
Really sounds like it, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, good luck, Alan. Thanks a lot for calling. And Todd in La Crosse. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, hi, thank you. I have heard there is a fruit fly, the spotted wing Drosophila. Mm-hmm. It's become a bad pest on the raspberries. It is in La Crosse County, and I've heard it's real devastating. But we actually have a lot of other fruits, and I wondered if you could tell me, would I expect bad problems on things like cherries, peaches, Juneberries, honeyberries, and strawberries?
Well, it's an interesting question. So this is number 96, I think, in my list of critters that arrived in the state when I was on the watch. And technically speaking, thin-skinned fruit is susceptible. So cherries should be, strawberries should be, peaches should be. But the two-year history that we have of it in the state, it's been a fall raspberry problem. We've seen very little at other times, and to be honest, we're a little confused here because it as I said, in other parts of the country, it attacks other things. We're not seeing it here, and why? An easy way of putting it, we don't start seeing pressure until the end of July and into August from this thing. And so, you know, the early strawberries seem to be done. I don't know why they're not doing more in peaches, although we don't have a lot of peaches. It's almost as if this thing is dormant for the first part of the season, and then it wakes up in July. I mean, that's just been my experience. In fact, the big question at this time last year, we were asking, can that little stinker spend the winter?
Yeah.
So we're watching and watching, and I'll tell you that the activity in the state turned on like a light statewide the same week, which argues that they did spend the winter. They didn't blow in here, which was Phil's theory originally, and that didn't hold water. As I said, it's gonna be a little bit of a learning process, but with that experience, with as much problem we had in the fall raspberry crop and not seeing it in the other things, I'm starting to believe in this climate, maybe indeed it's going to be just kind of a later season problem. Fascinating insect, because it breeds on honeysuckle berries, it breeds on buckthorn berries. So there's a lot of thin-skinned wild fruit. It does not breed in cranberries, which we were delighted to find out in the state. They're too thick-skinned. They won't mess with it. Apples, it only tends to see to be a problem if there's something already bruised. But again, that has not developed into an issue. But fall raspberries are a stinker to grow because you have to be on top of them early. As soon as the fruit starts to color, they're showing up. So you're basically spraying before you know you got bugs.
There you have it, Todd.
Well, thank you. That's kind of good news. Not for the fall raspberries, but the rest are hopefully good.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our UW entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk about the world of insects here in Wisconsin with Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist. Great to have him visiting with us. And thank you for joining in, too. If you have a question, call us at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page. Maybe you've got an insect photo you want to show us. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Sandy in Appleton, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, we have a talk show here that had an entomologist on, and one man called up and he said he takes newspapers and rolls them up and flips them around in his yard, and the earwigs go to those, and then whenever he puts his garbage out, he picks them up and flips them in the garbage.
It works. In fact, another way I've seen that done is you throw the rolled newspaper, and then every morning you come and you shake it into a bucket of soapy water.
Ew.
So it's a type of trap, you know, and they fall in there and drowned. And again, what you're taking advantage of is their habit of looking for shelter when the sun comes up, and they go underneath the paper. And of course, the paper being damp, oftentimes because of the dew in the morning, is just a perfect environment. So, yeah, as I said, it's interesting when you study the biology of an insect and really think it through. You can often come up with a number of different ways of reducing populations. The only problem with this is it's pretty labor intensive.
Mm-hmm. Also, I wanted to ask you, I have about 50 banana boxes in the garage waiting to be sorted, and we have spiders, big spiders. I've already been bit horribly bad by a spider, and these things hang on the eaves, and I don't know how many are going to be in the garage when I crack the door open, because I haven't been out there in like 5 years. So I was wondering if you could maybe suggest something I can... I use sticky traps in the apartment, and I've caught a lot of spiders and pill bugs with those. But these are all over the place, and we've got, of course, some of the wolf spiders and the big juicy ones. Help.
Yeah, well, spiders, you know, part of the problem is that, you know, the more clutter, per se, that's there for them to hide, the happier they are. And it also makes them very difficult to get to. And so I really don't have any magic there. You can heat things and, you know, kind of disinfect them, but that doesn't seem to be very practical in the garage like this. To be honest, a lot of times for basements, I'm as big a proponent of just getting the shop vac out and kind of sucking things up that way and reducing the numbers, because spiders are, relatively speaking, slow to breed. And, you know, so it's not as if you go from one spider to 200 spiders in a month. That's typically not the case unless you've got them invading in or, you know, other things going on. So, I really don't have an easy answer there to help reduce the stuff if there's just that many nooks and crannies for them to hide into.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Andy. Rex in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Great. Appreciate your call.
I have ants in my front yard, and I'm wondering what's the correct way to get rid of them? Should I hire an exterminator to come, or is there something I can purchase to do it on my own?
Okay, so two things. The presence of ants in the yard doesn't pose the yard any problem. I mean, they don't kill the grass. The biggest problem ants have is if it's a type of ant that comes in for food, there's a nuisance. But not all ants do that. So
making large mounds.
Okay. So now what you're dealing with is something called a field ant, or Formica is the genus. And they will make quite big mounds. I guess the only problem I tend to see from them, because they're not an ant that likes to come indoors, is two things. If you mess with the nest, they bite. And so if you got kids or dogs, you got to be a little careful. The other thing is I've seen sometimes that they create such big mounds, you can't even mow over the darn thing. And so that's a concern. But the secret to dealing with them, so all the ants you're seeing active are what we call workers, which are sterile females. The secret to controlling ants is to kill the queen, and she might be 2 or 3 feet deep in that nest. And so that's where the challenge is. So you can treat it yourself. To do this, what I would suggest, when I see a nest like that, I usually get a rake, and I kind of disturb the nest a little bit, and then you usually see 2 or 3 channels where the ants are most active. I will take a steel bar or steel rod and drive it down in there as far as I can reasonably, you know, just pushing. So you're often going 18 inches, 2 feet. So now I have 2 or 3 channels. And then, to be honest, almost any garden insecticide you use, if I had to go buy something, I usually buy Liquid 7 is what it's called. It's a very common garden insecticide. And I like the liquid form because what I do is I mix it up in a bucket of water, according to the label directions, and I drench it down the holes. The whole idea here is to get it deep enough to kill the queen. If you just put it on the surface and try to push it down in there, honestly, I've not had good luck. But by doing this kind of spot treating individual nests, or if there's, you know, if it's a smaller nest the size of a softball, just put one big channel down the middle and pour this stuff so it's soaking down in the ground, and I think you'll have pretty good results.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. We had another ant question from Doris in Shawano County, who wonders, how can I possibly eliminate a small... I'm on the wrong one here. I should have gone to Annie, who was on Facebook. She's wondering about the little red ants. Here we go. The little red ants that get in her home. Yeah. She said, I use cinnamon because I don't like using poisons. Are there other ways to keep them out?
A couple thoughts there. There could be 3 or 4 possibilities. So it is more complicated than it seems when you say little red ant. One of the things, though, about ants is that they either feed on sweets or proteins. That's an important question to ask because the best way to deal with ants is to bait them. You can use a boric acid bait with honey that's sold. And the idea of a bait is they pick it up and they feed each other. And so that it gets back to the queen. And you can be very judicious of where you apply it and the like. Now, what cinnamon is a repellent. So you put it across the windowsill, and you could use wintergreen oil. You can use almost anything, and the ants won't cross that barrier. But you're not killing ants. And the problem is they can find another way to get in the house. And so, as I said, if it gets to be bothersome enough, you think you have to intervene, try to find out what they seem to like the most, and you can just put a piece of honey out on a piece of wax paper and put a piece of cooking oil and see. And some ants will go after both. And then go buy the correct baits to do this. And then at least if they get bait acceptance, this will go at and control the colony by killing the queen.
Yeah. There we go. Let's go to Joe and Harper's Ferry next. Joe, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Another ant question. I lived in Florida for a number of years, and we had the fire ants down there. First question, are they the same red ants we see up here?
No.
And secondly, I was into the veterinarian's office one day and talking about it, and he suggested I get a friend. We each get a shovel. We each take a big bite out of the center of a mound that's 20 or 30 feet apart and swap them. And they would fight each other, and pretty much it seemed to work. I'm curious if that's valid, actually, if it's just anecdotal for my situation.
Well, you know, colonies do become very defensive, and hypothetically, yes, but the whole idea is the queen killed or not? And a lot of times I can see where they're so defensive. Now, fire ants, you know, that's a whole different animal to deal with, and thank goodness we don't have to deal with them here because they can sting and the like, and yeah, they do pose quite the challenge. But even our field ants, could you conceivably, because even without you intervening, sometimes you find the ants are picking on each other, and there are ant wars, which are great for kids to observe, you know, and the like. I remember spending a little time as a kid just sitting there and watching the ants go back and forth. But as I said, ultimately, when we're dealing with them, I'm trying to make that decision. Is it worth doing an effort? Are they doing something that we need to deal with? But then it's the case of where's the queen and how do I get to her? You know, and if I can solve that, then I figured out how to deal with them.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. We have Lynette in Richfield. Hi, Lynette.
Good morning. I'm in Southern Washington County, and I have several ash trees, and I'm assuming that I really need to address the emerald ash borer. So I'm wondering, how do I make sure that the landscaper that I select is actually doing the correct treatment?
Mm-hmm.
And about what kind of cost am I looking at per, I know it goes on diameter of each tree, so if you know, just approximately, I've got about six or seven of them.
Well, you know, you throw a cost anywhere from $20 to $40, $50 a tree. It depends a little bit what they use for the year. And there are some products they use that will last for 2 to 3 years. You know, it's there's enough information out there now. You can ask the landscaper what chemicals you use, how are they going to use it, and then just compare to the recommendations. Chris Williamson in our department makes recommendations both for homeowners and professionals, very similar at other states, Michigan State, other states in the Midwest that are dealing with this. You know, one of the ways is, you know, certified arborists, you know, have proven their competency. Now, everybody that applies pesticides in the state of Wisconsin has to be commercially certified by the Department of Agriculture. And what I'll tell you about that is that that means they can handle these products safely. It does not imply to me that they are experts at what they do. They're just legally they can apply the stuff. Whereas a certified arborist is somebody that has went through basically a test which is proving. So, you know, back in the day, I would have called them a tree doctor when I was growing up because, again, their interest is kind of the whole plant health rather than just applying chemicals. And so that would be some of the questions I ask when I'm dealing with people is like, but it's pretty straightforward. They've got some products they can drench in the ground that the roots uptake it, or they can put products that they inject into the trunk to the tree. And there's various advantages depending on the size of the tree and the like. But if done correctly, it should. And you are definitely, again, in the hot zone. There's enough activity around you that if these are valuable trees to you. And, you know, one of the discussions we tell people is that, you know, these products are very effective if used correctly. Big trees, it probably is more important to have it commercially done because they're a little trickier to deal with. smaller trees. You can even go to the local nursery store and whatnot and buy chemicals and apply it. Ultimately, if you figure that out, though, it might be, I'm not sure you're necessarily going to save yourself money, because often you have to buy dilute forms as a homeowner and you got to apply more product, and instead just kind of pricing it out. But if I had to give you an idea, it's at $20 to $50 a tree.
That's much cheaper than I was told by someone last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you recommend a 2-year treatment, or do you really care one way or the other?
Well, again, one of the products is recommends 2 to 3 years. In fact, my colleague Chris Williamson, it depends on the circumstance. He's got some cases up in plants he's watching in Newville where he's getting 4 years plus. So they're under ideal conditions. You get even a longer time, whereas other products are only an annual treatment. You know, and you've got to figure that out in the pricing to see what makes the most sense for you, or convenience-wise. They're both effective. It's just, again, some products by their nature have to be applied annually, whereas other products do have a longer residual.
Okay. Thank you so much. Very good information.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And really, you think about it, for a nice ash tree, $50 a year.
And in a real big tree, it may be a little bit more expensive, but, you know, the argument tends to be, and, you know, this is some work that's been done with other colleagues in the Midwest, is that, you know, you got a tree that's above 18 inches diameter, you know, and the value of that tree for the shade quality, the property value and whatnot is in the thousands of dollars. And so, again, investing a small amount on an annual basis to save it is well worth it. So it's not necessarily a life sentence, death sentence to these trees. You can pick the ones that are important in the landscape and put up the fight. The unfortunate thing is that it's going to be an annual fight. I mean, it's not as the one treatment that will go away forever. But as I said, I think a lot of arguments make it's well worth the effort to save these trees. I mean, there's some ash trees, some of those autumn purples. I just love that tree, and I can, you know, it's well worth the fight, I think.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist extraordinaire, he's going to be with us right up until 12:30, we'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we will be back with Phil. Stay with us. We'll be back. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, former director of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. He is taking your insect questions when you phone at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org, or also post question and photos as well, insect photos, at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. Great to have you along, and thank you so much for listening in. You know, we had some questions, quite a few email questions. Lori in McHenry, Illinois, was wondering about natural tick repellent remedies. She heard peppermint extract would work. Is that true? And what else might you recommend?
Well, when you look at tests, there's various things can for the short run make a tick not go where you want it to go. But as far as relying on stuff that has been scientifically proven to protect you against ticks, and in particular now because of the disease vector, this is, I mean, bringing it into a category, we're talking about significant health. I think that the, you know, DEET is definitely not natural, but I'm not a big fan of DEET. The product of choice is basically permethrin, which is a synthetic pyrethroid insecticide. Now, pyrethrin is a natural insecticide, but the synthetic versions have been molecularly manipulated so they're more stable. You do not put them on your clothing. I mean, on your skin. You put them on your clothing. And the products now, once they're there, many of them will last for 2 to 3 washings, and they're 100% effective.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, because of the risk of getting Lyme disease and anaplasmosis and aeruginosis and all these other things, you know, the risk of putting those chemicals on, if you use them, in fact, you read the directions, you're not supposed to have them on your clothes. You spray the clothes, let it dry, and it dries very quickly, and then you put your clothes on. Very little exposure, and those same chemicals are used in more concentrated forms as head louse shampoos and creams if you get scabies, mites, and whatnot. So it's not as if they have not been looked at. As I said, I think the dilemma with these natural products is they're in many cases unproven. You know, some of the natural oils honestly have their own toxicity. They cause burning. They cause, you know, even some of them in high concentrations are cancer causing. And so I think, you know, historically it's been a little frustrating is if people make the assumption if it's natural, it's safe. And if it's not, you know, synthetic, it's not. And you really have to dig deeper. And so, as I said, I know of some products. In fact, I was reading about a repellent that's in trial right now that looks absolutely amazing and has broad spectrum of repellency, even against potentially agricultural pests, but it's not a natural product. This is going to have to go through a lot of testing to see what the safety concerns are and the like. So as I said, you can read about things, people can make some claims, but when you look at the science, they're often not effective for very long. And again, when you're taking something as significant as worrying about something that can make you very sick, as I said, I think you have to look at approaches. And there are clothing you can buy with the stuff impregnated in. I mean, it depends which direction you want to take it. But that, to me, is the most effective way of preventing tick complications.
We have John in Duluth, Minnesota, with a question for you, Phil. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi. Looking at a problem with some carpenter ant infestations. We have a new home that was built with structural insulated panels with the white beadboard type insulation, and they love to nest in that stuff. Apparently have a satellite nest, and I've tried some insecticides and so forth, and the problem just keeps coming back, wondering if there's a bait or something.
Something to do, and you're breaking up on us, John. So
okay, so you know, carpenter ants, you don't typically have problems in new homes unless they find an environment that they like, and we find that some of the styrofoam insulation and whatnot, you know, it's not wood, it's not wet, but it's a place that they would like to live. So if you know where it is, to be honest, you can spot treat it with a dust, not a spray, because you don't want to melt the styrofoam. But your life is a little more complicated here because it seems to be reoccurring, and so there's two directions you can think about. There are carpenter ant baits on the market, but to be honest, the best carpenter ant baits are not going to be found at the local hardware store. You're going to have to order them on the internet. These are products like Advion and whatnot that are more typically sold to commercial pest control companies as a product. The other product is that you could consider. There is an insecticide called fipronil. It's the same thing that is in Frontline on a dog. But it is sold under the name Termidor, and it's basically a termite treatment for the outside exterior of a home. Now, this you would have to have commercially applied. It's not typically sold to homeowners. More of a marketing decision. But the interesting thing about a barrier treatment of Termidor, so if you apply it on the outside of your house once a year, the ants do not detect it's there, so they crawl through it. And those carpenter ants have to go outside to eat. And so what they find is a Termidor treatment, even though you don't know where the nest is, will wipe the colony out because the ants continually crawl through this treated area. One of the advantages to me is you're treating the outside of the house, not the inside, so there's far less exposure to people. It gets tied up very quickly. And so in your case, that is one thing I would consider, is if it just doesn't seem you're able to put the fires out here, is look into a single application a year. It's no reason to have multiple applications. Of this product is an outside barrier treatment. And as I said, it really has turned out to be very, very effective. In fact, a researcher out in the West Coast that has worked with us has talked about even wiping out carpenter ant colonies that could be 50 to 70 yards away from the house if it's a big tree and they're coming in the house for food. The same thing. There's enough activity. And there's some transfer where one ant gets it when it's touching other ants. You get some transfer there. So as I said, I think that would be the kind of final ace in the hole. If I can't get them any other way, is have a Termidor treatment applied, and you will take care of the ants.
There you go. Good luck, John. Thank you for calling. Frank in Johnson Creek. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is box elder bugs. They're very heavy in fall, but I get them in my house year-round. I don't know if they come through the light fixtures or how to get in, but...
Okay, so what their claim is they're looking for shelter in the fall to spend the winter. And if they get into your wall voids or attic, then when things warm up, and that could even be in January if you're in the right spot, they come through the light fixtures. They're just looking as a way out. So the line in the sand is basically the first week of September, as far as I'm concerned. Either you stop them at that time by usually applications outside on the exterior, or better yet, if you can solve where they're squeezing in, but sometimes that's not possible, but... you know, so they can't get in to begin with, you've won. But once they get in access to your walls, there's no sprays that are going to work because you can't get the sprays to them. And usually by this time of the year, they start kind of running their course because they can't breed in your walls. They have to get back out in the trees when the trees start to produce seed and whatnot, because that's basically what they feed on. So as I said, you know, the treatments outside, whether you have them commercially done or you can go to the local, you know, hardware stores and whatnot and buy products, but you spray the sunny sides of the house, you'll notice how they cluster in the fall. That's right. The best time to get them. You can even kill them with soapy water. The difference between the soapy water and some of the sprays is residual. Soap kills only on contact, whereas some of the sprays, if you apply it, one spray will last 3 to 4 weeks, and that will give you the protection you need to keep them before they get that fall migration.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks, Frank. Appreciate the call. And we had an email from Doris in Shawano wondering, how can she possibly eliminate a small half-inch moth which flies out of her kitchen cupboards?
Mm-hmm.
They get maybe in the flour or some cereal products. What could I spray with? Well, you wouldn't want to spray, would you?
Yeah, so, you know, it's probably Indian meal moth. If not, there's an almond moth, a Mediterranean flower moth. There's about 5 or 6 species of dry goods pest moths. And anything that is dried plant material, so spices, potpourri, tea, but cereals, nut meats, raisins, and the like. And to be honest, I think the approach is one of two things. You go through the cupboards, you throw out what you know has bugs. You often see webbing, you often see little white worms. And then other things that you've got around for an extended period of time, you've got to put in packaging they can't get into. So we're talking, you know, plastic snap containers or screw top jars or the like, because the problem most people have is you get rid of most of them, but there's a few around, they lay eggs, and then now you've got a new fire is what the problem is. So it's all about sanitation and exclusion. And I always tell people, if you've got these kind of moths, if you forget a box of Bisquick, and I hate to pick on Bisquick, but it's, you know, something we often have around for an extended period of time, so it has time to get infested, you can spray all you want and you still got a problem. Versus the other thing, if you clean out what's infested and prevent them from getting a new food, you don't have to spray at all and you've solved the problem. So I think it's a much better approach is to do the sanitation and exclusion and not something we normally recommend spraying for.
We have a caller who said the National Weather Service interrupted us when you were explaining how to get rid of the anthill, the large anthill, and the caller didn't, you know, some sort of severe weather thing that you and I, you know, actually didn't hear and didn't know happened. So do you want to give a quick recap of that?
Okay. So again, what's going on with this big ant nest is there's a single queen and she could be 2 to 3 feet down the ground and we have to get her. Now, if we had some good baits, that would be the way to go, but there are no good baits for the field ants that I know of in the state. So what typically works the best is to, you can disturb the nest a little bit. I only do that so I can see the main channels they have, but I use a big metal rod or bar, and I push it down those main channels. So I'm making a 18-inch to 2-foot deep a channel that's getting as deep down in the nest as I can get. Then I mix up my product. If I had to go buy something, a very common insecticide to get at the hardware stores that they use on vegetable gardens and for all kinds of things is called Sevin, S-E-V-I-N. You follow label directions. I mix it up in a bucket. Why I like the liquid is because it mixes very easily. The powdered stuff or the dust are a lot harder to work with. And then I just pour that down those channels so it's going as deep as it can go. And honestly, if you've got a 4-foot nest, it might take a gallon of mixed product, you know, under the 3 or 4 things to get it soaked well enough and deep enough. On occasion, I've had to treat a nest a second time, but not very often. Any other treatment, even if you mix the stuff up and you pour it on the intact nest, it doesn't penetrate deep enough to get to the queen. So you knock them out. And I'll tell you, when you treat, the ants will stop being active in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes because they're repelled by the spray. This is the same thing that happens with the cinnamon oil or peppermint. Mm-hmm. They're repelled by these odd chemicals, but that's not killing them. They're just not being active. The queen would still survive if it was one of those treatments. Whereas again, if I can get this chemical down to where she is found, she dies. Once she dies, the colony has no capacity to reproduce and you've solved the problem.
We have Daniel on Facebook wonders, how do I get an early start on controlling beetles that plague my squash and zucchini plants every year?
The cucumber beetles overwinter as adults. And one of the problems, they carry the bacteria wilt in their stomach. So there's really kind of a 2-prong headache if they survive. Because of that, when you put your transplants out and the like, you'll often get not many, but just a few. But this is basically the mothers of the next 2 generations. So early control. To be honest, when you see the first beetle in the spring, and, you know, technically I could even expect to find one this week if we had the right conditions. But, of course, people aren't going to get those plants out for a while. So get them out there. You start to see the first beetles treat and knock them out before they get a chance to reproduce. And that's the best shot you've got. And then you're often okay until you get into end of July and August. And then the concern is that the first generation, they're migrating in from elsewhere. So you probably might have to treat again. But as I said, because of the weakness of this insect's life cycle of overwintering as adults, starting the next generation, and being attracted to those first plants that are put out there, that's when you want to stop them.
John in Fountain City, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Yes, hi. Hey, I was wondering about crickets. And it's not, it doesn't seem to be just your black field cricket. It's almost like a light brown or tan. And it seems in a basement. It seems the last probably 4 or 5 summers.
Okay, real big, kind of humpback, real long antennae?
Right.
Okay, so they're called camel or cave crickets. And the interesting thing is that they're predators. You know, they eat other insects. And so a lot of it depends where your house is located. You're next to a bluffy area, you tend to get problems. Honestly, somebody that's out in the middle of a sandy area, they don't even know what you're talking about. So they're migrating in is the biggest thing. They're not, you know, probably not reproducing. They're just migrating in. That nice damp environment is what they're looking for to hang out. So this is a case where exclusion might be a way of dealing with it. Again, look along the base of your foundation and see if there's any kind of openings they're using. Or, as I said, the weakness of most homes is that interface between the siding and the foundation. There's often a spacing that bugs, millipedes, and ants and everybody else can squeeze up through. So sealing that up with whatever, expanding foam or, you know, copper wool, those kind of things, often makes a significant difference. And again, if you solve the riddle of how they're getting in, you're done. It doesn't go on for the next 20 years and you will not have cave crickets down in the basement. Drying things out would help, but basements often, depending on various structures, sometimes it's hard to get them dry enough, but that would change the environment. But as I said, I know that they're migrating and they're not breeding there, and that's what I think you got to take advantage of.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck, John. Thanks. Mary in Egg Harbor. Hello. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you so much. How would you get rid of wire worms or these real... I've heard them called wire worms. They're hard as a rock, maybe 2 inches long, and they curl up in a round circle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you step on them, they crunch. They're
right.
Really hard.
So they are millipedes. And
they are.
And, you know, the way you could confirm this is true, wireworms only have 6 legs. Millipedes, if you look close, have 2 pairs of legs for every body segment. There's all kinds of little tiny legs on these things. And what happens is when they migrate indoors, it's a dead end. Nothing to eat, too dry, they die. So it's always an outside problem.
Right.
But where life gets difficult, as I will tell you, we know at times millipedes that are coming in your basement are coming from 200 yards away from your house. They're migrating in at night. And then when the sun comes up, they're like earwigs. They're looking for cool, damp places. And so that's where they squeeze into the house. And so it's been quite frustrating if you are in the wrong place where you have this beautiful house out in a rural area and there's all kinds of prairies and grasses and CRP ground because the organic matter that those produce are millipede heaven. So they're reproducing by like crazy, and then they go through this migratory phase. And so you're getting these marches of millipedes coming in. And as I said, there's no practical way of killing them to any degree. And even sometimes I've seen the numbers, you kill 90% of them and the 10% that remain still cause a major problem. So then I go back to this issue of how are they squeezing in and what can I do to stop it? Anything you can do to dry things up, you know, get more sun, get less plants is going to be less conducive to have them hang around. But as I said, if they're showing up in the basement, try to figure out where they're squeezing through and get it sealed up and keep them outside. And then I think they won't be near the problem.
Yeah.
Oh, they're in the garage.
Well, see, yeah, what happens there, it's the coolness of the slab is attracting them. So yeah. They're migrating in from, as I said, sometimes it's easy to pick up the place. It's, you know, it's the big prairie, you know, out in the backyard. But the problem is, how do you stop that? I mean, there really is, I got sprays that will kill a few of them, but as far as really solving it, it doesn't.
Now, there you go. Thanks, Mary. Donna in Bailey's Harbor. Hi.
Hello. Yes, I was the last 2 years, as the first time I've seen these, it's a gray-bodied squash bug. it's on zucchini, basically any of the squash plants.
Mm-hmm.
And they came a little bit 2 years ago, kind of later in the season. Last year were pretty early. They have a little copper-colored sort of egg they lay underneath the leaves, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of them, they're prolific.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this colder winter might have taken care of them, and what can I do when I first start seeing them?
I have seen more squash bugs in the last 10 years than I did early in my career. But to be honest, there's about 4 species of squash bugs in the state, and I don't think it was cold enough. May have slowed them up a bit, but I don't think it would have eliminated them. Much like the earlier conversation about the cucumber beetles, squash bugs overwinter as adults. And right away, they start coming on early in the spring. And so when you see the first eggs, you know that you're about the time you're going to have to intervene. The problem is they're on the undersides of the leaves.
Right.
And so you've got to be very thorough with your spray. You can even kill them with soapy water. Again, various both organic and non-organic insecticides, but you're catching the small bugs are easier to kill than the adult bugs. The other thing that I've seen work to some degree is knowing that the squash bugs are looking for shelter. I've talked to people who had some success in the fall of the year of throwing out a shingle or some other kind of protected device. So, you know, we always preach about cleaning up the garden, getting rid of the dead plant material because of plant disease and the like. But here we're taking advantage of the fact that they're looking for shelter. You put one of these shingles or a few shingles out, hoping that the adult squash bugs crawl underneath it to spend the winter. And now when I lift them up, I've got them trapped, you know, and I can physically, we're a little late for that now, as I said, but something to consider in the fall to kind of concentrate the local populations and then physically deal with them. But now just watch. I mean, I can tell you, and sometimes the way the spring progresses, you know, all the adults come out at once and we got a very small window we have to deal with. But sometimes these little stinkers string out and cause problems, and their populations continue to build as we go through the summer. So, as I said, just like the cucumber beetles, I know they're searching out plants in early June. And I mean, you can hand pick them. I mean, if you got enough time to watch, but
I did it the first year that worked. I just squished them, but they're very prolific, and the egg seems to be extremely hard.
Yeah, you know, and I'll be honest with you, there's really nothing that I have any faith that kills eggs.
Okay.
You know, we have to wait until they hatch, but the little tiny nymphs of the squash bugs are very easy to kill, and they're often clustered together, as you can see. And this here's again where the soap works great on the little guys. The bigger ones, what happens with soap is if an insect becomes too thick-skinned, it's not very effective. And so that's why I don't have as much faith in that particular product as they get bigger.
Okay, well, I'll do my best. Thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. Robin and Portage, you have a quick question?
Well, I will try to make it quick. Okay, my grapevines. Every year I have this little, obviously it's not an adult, it's inside of the leaf,
yep.
Gets into the leaf, and it eats the whole leaf as it's a baby. I don't know what it is, whatever.
Or how what to do about it. Okay.
So it is an aphid relative we call a phylloxera. The funny growth you see is called a gall in the animals living inside it. And this is a sucking insect. It sucks the life out of it. A very difficult insect to control because it has stages on the roots and stages on the leaves. But it's controlled typically by the kind of grapes you've got, because American rootstocks and American grape-based grapes have some natural resistance to this thing, whereas Europeans and the like cause problems. So it's not an easy insect to deal with. There are some systemic insecticides that have been used out in California and the like, but you know, I think the problem there is if it's a susceptible variety, it's a constant fight. You know, one of the things you might have to consider is if you've got particular varieties that are very susceptible, is look to have some resistant varieties instead.
That's unfortunately, we are out of time. Can't do any more, Robin. Thank you so much for calling. Phil, you'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
We'll be back in about a month.
Phil Pelletieri, our insect specialist, will be back in about a month. We'll do it all over again with him. Sure, there'll be a whole new batch of things to talk about. There always is. And Dr. Sandy Sawchuk joins us tomorrow to talk about your pet's health. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.